Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com. Well, folks, here at the Bloomberg offices in New York, I've spent the morning watching Allison Williams run, literally run, back and forth between her desk, Bloomberg Television Studio, and now the Bloomberg Radio Studio. Why, you may ask, is because it seems like every major bank reported earnings this morning, so she is in great demand. Allison Williams covers all things financials for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo, you know, you've had a couple of hours to kind of cut through all the details. As you step back, how do you view kind of the current environment for the big banks that you've been covering for so many years?
So I think the revenue environment remains a big question, right? And that relates to trade and tariffs, Brexit, all the geopolitical uncertainty. We sort of knew we wouldn't get an answer on that today, but I think where we did get an answer is who has some levers to pull. And I think that's one place where JP Morgan is executing 18% return on tangible equity. Pretty impressive. That's the best among the banks. And they showed, gaining share in trading, doing well on loan growth, so that helps to offset some of the margin pressure, and then cost flexibility, the guidance coming down there. So those were all positive. If we look across the other companies, you know, Wells Fargo, I think it's sort of the earnings are less important than the incoming CEO, but they took a big litigation charge clearing the decks for Charlie Scharf, so that's a positive. Citigroup, I think, you know, the questions are rising regard to the returns for next year. It looks like they're going to be able to make their target this year, but next year is a question. 12% versus the 18% that JP Morgan did this quarter. Citi is executing around a 12%, hoping to make that target for this year. So I think costs remain the question for them. And then on Goldman Sachs, you know, fees coming in weaker, the equity income coming in a little bit weaker just due to what's happening in the market, the IPO pause, et cetera, and costs a little bit higher for them.
I wanted to sort of go and drill into the consumer, because a lot of the banks, JP Morgan included, are expanding in their consumer lending businesses, and people have been looking for signs of a possible slowdown amid the consumer strength that we continue to see. What was the reading there?
So I don't think that we're seeing a slowdown so far. And in fact, you know, Citigroup talking about the fact that, you know, even though, you know, they're keeping a tight rein on costs, but they also think they can have revenue growth. And part of that is the consumer. Keep in mind, they have a much bigger credit card business than many of the other competitors. JP Morgan also showing some health. And we did see in the government data sort of a pickup in consumer loans, especially in auto lending. We're going to hear, I think, more about that broadly from the banks as they come in this week.
So, Allison, you mentioned JP Morgan had a return on tangible equity of about 18%. That seems like, if I remember back, almost pre-financial crisis-like. And I know the bear case coming through the financial crisis was whole new set of regulations. They're never going to generate those kind of returns. So give us a sense of kind of the profitability and the returns we're seeing from some of the big banks you cover.
Yeah, and so to your point, you know, they're executing sort of top of their game. And I think what's impressive is that they're doing that in an environment where they are holding more capital. And in fact, you know, one of sort of the interesting side notes, what's been going on in the repo market, that's coming up on the calls, and JP Morgan talking about the fact that because of restrictions, they weren't perhaps as active in that marketplace as they might have been in the past. So sort of, you know, an eye towards regulation there. But in general, if you look at return on assets, so that adjusts for some of the leverage and some of the changes, we are executing at a very high level, and that's what we'd expect to be because we are late cycle. And so as much as we talk about the revenue concerns, keep in mind that credit, very solid. We can just continue to see very strong results across the banks.
Allison Williams, thank you so much for being with us. Allison Williams, who is the hardest working woman in Bloomberg this morning. Allison Williams, Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst, covering all things bank. It is no secret. People are searching for income. This has been a theme for the, past decade. And increasingly, they have been turning to convertible bonds. These are bonds that have an option to convert into securities, into stocks, given certain triggers. Joining us now, Dave King, Senior Portfolio Manager with Columbia Threadneedle Investments based in Boston. Dave, you focus on convertible debt and your funds. I was looking at one of them. It's up more than 15% year to date, doing really well. What's been sort of the winning aspects of convertible bonds this year?
In the current year, it's been the recovery in equities. Convertibles are typically issued by companies with growth opportunities. So when the market bounced back, the equity market, I mean, from a bad Q4, leadership has been smaller, growthier stocks, and our world is that world. Those are the underpinnings of the bonds and preferreds that we buy. So it's been good equity performance in areas like software, a rebound in semiconductors, and then just isolated good performers in other areas that have led the charge for us and for the market.
So, Dave, when bankers go in and they're pitching a convert to a corporate issuer, you know, sometimes I guess, you know, maybe the argument could be, well, I'll just sell equity here. What's the real advantage to an issuer by issuing a convertible bond?
Well, compared to issuing equity directly, the process is much quicker to do a convertible. They can be issued under Rule 144A and just sold to qualified institutions. So companies can get transactions done in the hundreds of millions of dollars in one day's time or overnight without the lengthy registration process. In terms of the contrast to issuing a bond, you often find that the bond market is a backward-looking market that favors the old economy. So companies in areas like biotechnology or SaaS are challenged when it comes to dealing with the high-yield market dynamics and find the convertible market much more friendly.
I'm looking right now at the market value of the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Convertibles Index, and it's about $219 billion of securities. And the reason why I ask is because there was a problem in the past bunch of years where convertible bonds were more popular with investors than they were by issuers to sell them. And I'm wondering how that dynamic has evolved today.
Yeah, that's a great observation. It remains a problem as far as I'm concerned. To put it in perspective, 20 years ago, the high-yield market and the convertible market were similar in size. In 2016, new issuance in the high-yield market exceeded the total size of the convertible market. So we've been a dwarf here because of the government focusing on very low yields, quantitative easing and so forth. But the good news is last year was a record.
Can you hash that out? What exactly is the reticence on the part of companies to sell these bonds?
Well, they can get cheaper money elsewhere as yields have been forced down dramatically. I mean, what we discuss as being the quote-unquote high-yield market is a five-handle market. That used to be a seven- or eight-handle market. So even in the context of a strong stock market, it's like, why give away a call option on your equity when you can finance so cheaply? So that's been the reticence. But the good news, as I said, is that last year was a record year for issuance. And this year, actually, through 9 months, was running ahead of last year. So there is a recovery in convertible issuance, but nowhere near where I think it will be if rates normalize at levels they were in the past.
So, Dave, I remember back in the financial crisis, some industries and companies that were really struggling, like airlines and autos, they went to the convert market. Is that kind of, you know, saving the company type of financing? Do we still see that in the market today?
Well, it hasn't been as necessary after 10 years of economic recovery, but it's absolutely one of the functions of our market. The main uses of the convertible market are to finance disruptive growth companies, to finance M&A, and to finance survival of the enterprise. So when I think back to joining Columbia about 10 years ago, as you point out, there were a lot of airline issues, home building issues. Ford Motor was a big issuer. They wisely did converts instead of having to file bankruptcy. So yes, the economy is cyclical. When the cycle heads down, we'll see a lot of issuance in areas where the economy is struggling.
Just real quick, Dave, would you buy WeWork convertible bonds if they were to be sold?
Well, they have to have a stock, first of all.
So fair point.
We can't convert into nothing, but the
community adjusted stock.
Conceptually, it would be a very typical issuer in our market. If it was a public company and if they had a balance sheet problem, but could make the case, and this is hypothetical, they could make the case that they have a working business model, they would be welcome with open arms in our market, while skepticism would prevail in the high yield market and other places.
Dave King, Senior Portfolio Manager for Columbia Threadneedle Investments, located in Boston. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we have a risk on day today, that's for sure. The equity indices up about 1%. And to be honest with you, I'm not really sure why. Maybe a little bit of lift from Brexit, maybe some
earnings.
Decent tech and health. What's that?
Earnings.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe a little tech, a little healthcare, pushing the market up. A mixed bag coming out of the big Wall Street banks. But hopefully our next guest can help us provide some color here. Frank Rubinsky, Chief Macro Strategist for Aegon USA Asset Management, based in Charm City. That'd be Baltimore, Maryland. But he joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Frank, just as today we had a nice move up here. What do you attribute it to?
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, I think what you're seeing in part, there's a macro story of this bear market in geopolitics, which is really bleeding into the economics. And that's affecting markets, right? So as you get these oscillations of the geopolitical side, you can see a quick reaction from a day-to-day perspective on the risk markets.
So what do you like?
So we are at this point, late in the cycle. We have been slowly going up in quality, and I'm talking about from a fixed income perspective. We think, going too far up in quality, like all the way to treasuries, doesn't make sense at this point. You've already had, say, the 10-year being, the yield cut in half. And we think it's more of a coupon clip from here at best. So we'd be looking kind of the mid-tier corporate credit, because we also think, looking at the triple C's, kind of the really low end, you're not going to have the oversized growth that those companies need to really grow into their balance sheets.
So I do want to bring you a headline just crossing the Bloomberg that WeWork, that the board of We Companies is reported to be working with Perella Weinberg Partners. That would suggest at some sort of restructuring. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, WeWork bonds falling to an all-time low today. How much of a specific story do you think WeWork is? And how much do you think it represents some broader potholes that we're going to see down the line with other companies in the debt market right now?
I always think it's interesting how these types of stories, they don't tend to happen at the start of a cycle, right? You get these late cycle when capital is looking for return, looking for yields, and you get these misallocation of capital. Think of the 90s tech, right? I mean, I think this is on a macro level, this is similar to that type of thesis. This is where, especially when you get into these low liquid type, really low quality names, the credit analysis really becomes important. Because if you're just passive investing, it's really hard, from a price discovery standpoint, having that, you can't focus on the story. It's more about the cap structure and the balance sheet and the realistic component of that story. So.
Well, it sounds like Bloomberg News was out with a report this morning, that JP Morgan is, might be shopping around a, multi-billion dollar, capital structure bond, 15%, coupon payment in kind, some terms we haven't heard about for such a long time. That screams kind of end of cycle. Just give us a sense in your portfolio, how is kind of the credit quality, I guess, for lack of a better term? Does it feel late cycle to you? Are there warning signs there, or is the overall economy, which is still pretty strong, kind of supporting most of the credits?
Well, so I'll start with the economy side and then go into the portfolio side. So on the economy side, definitely late cycle. I mean, we're moderating from peak growth, and we see trend growth in the high ones, and we think we're going there. We don't see the cycle necessarily ending, next year. So, we think from that perspective, you could have kind of trend-like growth, which is not bad for certain parts of credit. When we talk about the portfolio side, we have been on an up in quality type mode for quite some time. If we look at the low end of high yield, the triple C's, we're underweight there, trying to go up. And if you look at the Sharpe ratios, I mean, they're definitely being maximized in kind of the mid part of the credit structure, because you've also been assuming a lot of risk with the volatility you've seen on some of the lower end side of the credit space. So we've definitely been on this up in quality, but as I said before, not going all the way up in quality, because we don't think, despite the trade fears, and kind of the uncertainty around that, we don't see the global cycle completely ending.
Okay. Triple C credits have underperformed. A lot of people agree with you. A lot of people have been doing the same thing. If I were a contrarian, I would go into triple C's and say, well, if we're not at the end, these things are going to plug along. There's a lot of capital and private debt and private equity kinds of structures. So I'll be fine. What would you say to that person?
Well, I hope his credit analysis is quite sharp. I mean, I think it's helpful when you look at this cycle versus prior cycles in the sense of, in the 80s, 90s, nominal growth was 6-7%. Now, we're happy with 3%. And, when you're at a slower nominal growth world, it's harder to get the aggregate low end of the credit space. They need growth, right, to grow into those balance sheets. So I think, will there be companies that survive and do well in triple C? Yes. But again, I think buying a bucket of triple C's is going to be, you're going to be taking on more risk, so that Sharpe ratio will be affected, as opposed to having a really experienced and sharp analyst who can, really figure out the credit specifics there.
You might be buying a bucket of worms. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. It's Tuesday.
Is Frank Rubinsky. Credit,
no, it's okay. It's absolutely nothing. Okay. It's something I just made up. So you can write your comments to LeBromowitz@Bloomberg.net. Frank Rubinsky, thank you so much for being with us. Frank Rubinsky is Chief Macro Strategist at Aegon Asset Management, helping oversee $103 billion of assets from Baltimore. What did you call Baltimore?
Charm City.
Charm City.
Yeah.
Who knew? Paul, we hear so much about the ESG label, environmental, social, and governance types of filters to invest more selectively and more wholesomely in equities. Joining us now is someone who focuses on that all day long, Anna Marie Washer, founder and chief executive officer of Flat World Partners. Disclosure, she is not a flat earther. That is not the title of her firm. But Anna Marie, why don't you just start with telling us what it does do?
Sure. So Flat World Partners is an investment management firm, and we focus on custom solutions for impact and sustainability that deliver market rate returns.
So talk to us about ESG investing in general. Just size up the market for us, the growth of ESG investing. Give people a sense of how big this may be.
Sure. So if we look at numbers this year, $9 trillion of assets are already in ESG or SRI negatively screened funds in public markets. And
SRI negatively screened? Is that
yes.
A medical test?
Yeah, exactly. There's so many acronyms. I think that's part of the challenges of the market, but it's socially responsible investing when you screen out tobacco or oil and gas. The market's growing so significantly right now, over 100% annually in terms of the flood of types of funds that are launching in fund flows.
So give us a sense of performance. Do I sacrifice performance if I integrate ESG into my investment process?
Right. No, the good news is you don't. In fact, more and more studies show outperformance. When you look at ESG data providers, you see that there's larger and larger gaps between traditional indexes and those indexes that are ESG because you're mitigating risks.
Can you give us an example of kind of a hallmark ESG compliant or SRI negative plus
absolutely
beta X23 that you focus on?
Sure. I mean, if we look at public markets, you can use an example like PG&E and the outages last week. So that has been available in ESG data providers, and you've actually seen the risk assessments on ESG data increase over time, which would have given us an indication that the stock would collapse. And then you have opportunities
to
offset.
Actually, back up on that. Sure. I want to dig in a little bit more. So please explain a little bit more. What indicators would you be looking at that you would have been able to
see?
Sure.
So Bloomberg Terminal actually has ESG data on it, and you can see momentum scoring on whether E, S, or G factors are increasing or declining. That often shows an indication that stock may collapse if the scores are declining.
Okay, so which was declining the most when it comes to PG&E?
So that often falls under governance or environmental factors, because where the fires start in California are literally where they have utility centers.
So, you mentioned the data. A lot of times we've had ESG investors in here, portfolio managers, and they bemoan the lack of data or the lack of consistent data on ESG. It's not like going to an income statement or a balance sheet where it's, you know, gap kind of data and everybody's kind of got it. You mentioned the Bloomberg Terminal. We do on the terminal have tons of ESG data, but just give us a sense of, if I wanted to incorporate it, ESG, into my investing, kind of where do I get data? What's
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
The ESG data market is incredibly tricky. There's about 80 data providers in the market now, and the scores really skew significantly. There's no consensus scores. And so we're really working on technology to integrate platforms and incorporate unique data sets like Greenpeace ocean plastic contribution.
This is one of my troubles with the ESG label. I'm going to be really honest.
Sure.
I struggle with how vague it is.
Yeah.
I mean, to be socially responsible can mean 14 million different things to different people, and to have good governance, I mean, again, there are different screens, and really, what does it mean to be good to the environment? Is it if you have carbon offset, but you're pumping carbon, into the environment?
Right.
I mean, how confident are you that these screens really are something significant?
Yeah, so it's really about understanding how those screens are put together, or that ESG data, and understanding the managers that are building those products and how they incorporate it. All of our clients care about different things, whether it's water or education or the environment, and we want to really think about what are the key points that we need to highlight in an investment. You can't do it all. You can't incorporate everything in every investment.
So I can see how a pension fund or maybe even a big mutual fund would care about and incorporate ESG. How about the hedge fund community? Do they care? These are some pretty cold-hearted people who just look for, you know, the...
Well, we're starting to make them care. We actually just signed a partnership with Titan Advisors to evaluate 60 hedge fund managers and some of the larger ones on diversity issues, social issues, and whether they're incorporating ESG, and working with them to actually launch integrated ESG processes into their investment decision-making, because, again, we believe it'll remove risks from the portfolio and force them to make real changes.
You know, when you came in, I asked, you know, how much is private? You said impact investing tends to be private investments and ESG tends to be public markets. I'm wondering, in 5 years from now, do you expect the shift in money to be different than it is now in terms of where it's allocated? Because the impact side of things is pretty small, even though that's really what's going to building, you know, water sustainability in Africa and things like that.
Sure.
Versus trying to sort of encourage companies to behave well.
Yeah. I actually think ESG and impact won't exist in the future as a label, because it will be incorporated in every investment decision that is made. Regulations around carbon tax is being innovated. MiFID II change regulations for ESG. Beyond Meat is an impact company. It's one of the first to truly go public. And so you'll see impact flood into public markets, where stock exchanges also now require ESG standards before listing.
I first heard about ESG maybe 10 years ago, and it was mostly from European investors.
Yes.
So did it kind of start in Europe and then came over here to the U.S.?
It actually started with the nuns and Catholic pension plan
there
groups.
There we go.
Exactly. Shout out to the nuns.
Yeah, Mr. Sweeney.
Church paid off for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's a Catholic school. Interesting. So, but it's now becoming more and more embraced kind of globally?
It has. I think because people do see that the data providers have improved the analyst work that's being done. And there's responsibility and transparency of data, right? If Enron happened today, you know, news coverage from you guys would have happened in seconds, not later, or Twitter feeds. All of that data and innovation has created more transparency and responsibility.
Right, fascinating discussion. Anne-Marie Washer, thanks so much for joining us, giving us some more content and color on ESG investing. Anne-Marie Washer, she's a founder and CEO of Flat World Partners, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, giving us some thoughts. And Elisa, I was saying, you know, we probably have an ESG fund manager or someone like that in our studios, you know, every couple of weeks. It's becoming a bigger part of the investment.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.